Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
Johnny Giles is a national treasure. When he speaks, I mean, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. When he's on the show, I was in the car the other day. I parked the car and I sprinted into the house and turned on the radio. I love listening to him. I love Johnny Giles.
John Giles, every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Kenny Cunningham is with us this Wednesday morning. Kenny, how are you?
Morning, lads. All good.
Let's start with the late game last night, because you were chatting to the lads already about the early games. Leicester against Arsenal. Pretty good game. We had Gary Breen on a Monday morning after the win against Wolves, and he was saying there's positive signs, but he has huge reservations about where Arsenal still are defensively. Things have got better, though, haven't they? Even in the context of their defence last night, they looked a little less shambolic than they did 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I think they've been better since Arteta came in terms of from an organisational point of view. You can tell he's quite a diligent coach, and I think there's been a certain structure to what Arsenal have done since he's come into the football club. Hasn't always been hugely successful. Form has been a little bit up and down, but clearly there's been an improvement there in terms of the basic organisation of the team, certainly from a defensive point of view. I think he is limited in terms of the players he has available to him, particularly across the defensive line. I'm sure Breeny would have alluded to that. But I'm reasonably impressed with what I've seen from him. I think there's grounds for optimism there, particularly in relation to a lot of the forward-thinking players in the Arsenal setup, the young players in particular, some great talent there. But it's going to be a slow burn. It's going to be a slow road back, I think, for the Arsenal faithful over the next couple of years. Just have to show a bit of patience.
How important is it then that Mikel Arteta is really trying to lay down a marker in terms of the culture at the club? Like, we've seen a story this week that Matteo Guendouzi has been training on his own for the last 2 weeks, ever since that Brighton spat, and perhaps the lack of professionalism he showed on that occasion and the lack of an apology forthcoming. Whether or not it's right or wrong to be that harsh on a young player like that, it is still Mikel Arteta showing that the culture is hugely important to the club, and that can only be a positive in the long term, even if Guendouzi has to eventually leave the club.
Yeah, it's difficult to know on an individual situation like that from the outside looking in. I'd be very surprised if he's taken that stance, Arteta, and ostracised him from the group for a two-week period just off the back of that one incident at Brighton. If there was a culmination of those things, maybe there was a question mark about his attitude of the player, how he's carrying himself around the training ground, how he's applying himself in training on a day-to-day basis. Mate, that's obviously a little bit different. It gives the whole thing a little bit more context. I think in that situation, you have to be seen to be taking a stance. I think the other players are looking to the manager saying, well, look, are you going to let this happen? You know, is he going to get away with this? So at some stage, you have to put your foot down. But generally speaking, I'm a fan of the young kid. He is a young kid. You have to remember that. He's still developing, still growing as a person and as a player as well. And my gut reaction would be to stick with him. I think any young player, I hate to see any young player leave a football club kind of cast aside to a certain extent. I think all the best coaches, managers kind of put the work in with a player and try to turn him around in the kind of short to medium term. So I hope it isn't the end of his Arsenal career, because I think he's got real talent, the lad. And I think they could do with him that kind of bit of energy that he brings, bit of bite to that central midfield area. It's been an issue for Arsenal for quite some time, but he may have his reasons, Arteta. But he needs to get it right, because you can get that kind of call wrong on sometimes. If you're seen to be kind of coming down hard on a young player, and the player actually has a sympathy of the majority of the players in the dressing room, that can be different. That can be counterproductive. That can go against you as a manager. If the perception amongst other players are, well, yeah, okay, he stepped out of line, but really, Gaffer, that's a little bit too much. So that can kind of go against you. You know, that can turn a number of the players against you as a manager. So you have to be careful. Every individual situation is different. But he's a new manager, Arteta. I understand the point that you're making in terms of trying to put a stamp as authority at the football club. But, you know, you always have to be aware, I think, any decision you make as a manager, the effect it has, how it's perceived by the whole group, not just that one individual.
Sure. Kenny, let's assume that this isn't just because of the incident, and that you're right, there's something deeper going on. And he's trying to teach him a lesson. When you're in a situation like Arteta, is in, there's a short window where you get to establish what that culture is going to be. You can see Guendouzi thriving at one of the super clubs that he's being linked with, where, for example, he's not thrust into the team straight away, and he's not being asked to be a leader. Or in the dressing room, for example, in three seasons' time, when Arteta has laid down exactly what the rules are, and everybody knows this is his team and he's the boss and everybody has to do what he has to say. But very early on in your managerial career, if there's any kind of distraction from a young player, he might be good enough to be in your team, but he might also not be the right character for this squad when you're just building what that culture is supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm never quite sure, Jared, the word culture, like, you know what I mean? It's one of those kind of buzzwords, I suppose. Like, I'm never quite sure exactly what it means. It means different things to different people, I think. But I'd like to think of, in the modern game, like, you get the impression, like, a lot of the kind of dressing rooms, a little bit maybe sterile, kind of lack of personality. And I think that's kind of to the detriment of the dressing room and all, honestly. I think as a manager, you can be a strong manager. You can rule. You can manage with authority. But you can also create an environment where you encourage, you know, a kind of an environment at the football club where, you know, players feel comfortable to express an opinion and show a bit of personality around the place. You know, it's not kind of computer-like in terms you come into the training ground, do your work on the training pitch, get your work done in the gym, physical conditioning. You know, it's kind of a robotic existence at the football club. Nobody questions the manager. You do what you're told. This is the culture. We want to improve. We want to get better. You're professionals. That type of thing. I mean, there's a certain level of that where you think, yeah, that's to be applauded. But for me personally, I always enjoyed a dressing room where, yeah, you had a certain type of work ethic, but the manager allowed players a little bit of license in terms of how they kind of reacted to other people, the kind of relationship they had, the kind of personalities they had. At times, maybe they stepped over the line on occasion. But I think that type of vibrant kind of dressing room was a dressing room which I kind of enjoyed. We always hear about lack of personalities in the dressing rooms these days. Probably no surprise when you're constantly hearing about a certain culture, managers want to impose a certain culture at a football club and a work ethic and those type of things. At times I get a sense of managers don't strike the right balance between those two things. And the best dressing rooms for me have both of those things, a kind of fierce work ethic amongst the players who want to win, want to be competitive, want to achieve things. But also you have those real kind of, you know, outlandish personalities, strong personalities in the dressing room who will voice an opinion, who kind of will fall out on occasion with themselves and with other people. So not really so much a right or wrong for me on that question.
Right, that's interesting. Is that something that perhaps existed in the Liverpool dressing room over the last couple of years, the idea of a kind of a very hard-working culture, but at the same time, there is sort of a lightheartedness to things. I accept that can always seem the way when a team is winning, and perhaps the greatest judge of a team is when they're actually got their back up and they're trying to get back up the table.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. Certainly, there's a strong personality in that Liverpool dressing room, and you'd imagine there's players there who wouldn't be who would be willing to voice an opinion on occasion in the dressing room, on the training pitch, or around the football club. I get the sense that's a very vocal dressing room at Liverpool. Not too many quiet voices around the place. You know, people voice an opinion, and not just about going around falling out with people and having arguments all the time. It's just having strong personalities there, like vocal people who want to have a conversation, and they were kind of, you know, really kind of energised the kind of the dressing room. And there's a kind of bit of a fun element to that as well. I mean, you don't want to go into work every single day. It can't be too serious, your work environment as well. And probably similar for yourselves, you go into work every day. Yes, you want to work. You've got to be professional how you approach things. But at the end of the day, you know, you want to be able to just chill out a little bit as well. And, you know, share a conversation with somebody, like, you know, laugh with somebody, that type of thing as well. So it's all about the right type of environment at a football club. It's slightly different from club to club. But for me, it's kind of a happy mix of all of those things, which is a kind of an ideal environment that you're looking for. So I'm hoping that's what Arteta's looking to do at Arsenal. But I sometimes get a sense in the modern game that with some managers, young managers as well, you know, it's all about the process. You know, it's all about the project. Yeah, the culture around the football club. And I always question sometimes exactly what that means.
We did want to get your take on Liverpool and what they might do in the off-season, Kenny. We're going to have a look at their depth chart. Go for it. What did he say?
Nothing.
Nothing. So thanks a million for your time this morning, Kenny. So the depth chart, Liverpool. So perhaps if we wanted to split hairs, we might have to get you splitting hairs a small bit this morning. What would Liverpool have to do in the off season? Like, it's a situation here where the team close to picks itself, the first 11. So we're going to be looking at who's option two quite a bit here today. We'll just start very briefly in goals. Adrian is obviously the nailed-on starter there. He's got another 4 years on his contract. The question is, what happens if Adrian gets injured again? Or if Alisson gets injured again, I should say. Sorry, Adrian is the backup. That is the question we're asking here. Do they need a new backup goalkeeper? He's got 1 year left on his deal, Adrian. He's not at Alisson's level, clearly. Is he the required level to even be a backup at Liverpool at the moment?
No, I think that's a fair question, Alan, because I don't think there's too many positions, even in the squad, let alone the starting 11, where you can really argue that Liverpool are at a disadvantage or there's any kind of slight weakness. I think probably the goalkeeping position, the number two, as you suggested, is probably that one. You've always got to think, manager, like that kind of worst-case scenario. You can't think Alisson's going to be fit. Presume he's going to be fit for the whole of next season or the season after that. So you have to make contingency plans where if he's out for a significant period of time, I know he missed about a month, was it month, 6 weeks or start of kind of last season. It wasn't a huge amount of time, particularly in terms of game time. So you have to make allowances for that and you have to look at Adrian. I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I think potentially they could strengthen in that area of the pitch. But it's easier said than done. Oh, and easy to say, I just go and get a better goalkeeper in. But there's all the top goalkeepers want to play. It's as simple as that. No top goalkeeper is going to come in and sign for Liverpool as a number two and play second fiddle to Alisson and play a small quota of games during the course of the year. So you've got to accept that the keeper who comes in as a number two to Alisson, there's going to be a certain drop-off in terms of ability. It has to be, because otherwise he's not going to come into the football club and accept second billing. Can you get a keeper of a better quality than Adrian? Possibly so. There might be keepers out there. You've got to throw a lot of money at them, obviously, to keep them happy. They're happy to keep the bench warm for the majority of the season. So it's going to take a big lump in terms of possibly transfer fee and certainly wages to keep them sweet, keep them happy. But I'd agree with you. I think potentially out there, there's a goalkeeper of a better quality than Adrian, who if they needed to lean on for a significant portion next season, that could be pivotal in terms of the league title next season. So yeah, I would agree with you. Probably the only area for me, the Liverpool team, that would probably have it that kind of discussion in terms of maybe strengthening in that area of the pitch.
If we move on to centre-backs, Kenny, consensus has emerged throughout the season that Joe Gomez is the partner for Virgil van Dijk. They are the starting centre-halves for Liverpool. You drop down to Lovren and Matip as your backups at this stage, and it is not like a drop-off to Adrian at this point. Matip has proven himself to be a consistent performer himself. Does that mean you don't need to sign? Does that mean Lovren and Matip playing behind Joe Gomez and Virgil van Dijk in your depth chart is where Liverpool can stay, and staying static in that position is fine this summer?
Yeah, I think so. As long as those two players are happy to do that, that's always the key. They're very experienced players, those two players. And I'd actually be a little surprised if both of those players were happy to turn up at Liverpool next season, knowing that Gomez and Van Dijk are Klopp's first pair. It'd be different if you're a young pro starting off, 19, 21 years of age, around the squad, and you're looking at Gomez, Van Dijk, you're still learning, you're still developing, think, well, I'll accept this for another 2-3 years. This is a great environment to be in. I'm only going to get better knowing that you've got 10, 12 years ahead of you still. That's not the case with Matip and certainly not Lovren. So wouldn't surprise me again, as successful as Liverpool have been, potentially one of those players, maybe even Lovren. You'd like to think possibly Matip just ahead of Lovren in the pecking order at the moment, Owen. So it wouldn't surprise me, in my experience, Lovren must have knocked on Klopp's door in the summer, in the off season, say, look, this, I've really enjoyed it here. It's been absolutely amazing, fantastic experience. But at my age, I just want to play now. I've got a couple of years left at a reasonably high level. I just want to play football. It's not going to happen for me here. Let's be realistic. We're not going to fall out over it. Just let me take a reasonable fee from you and let me go. So that'd be the only occasion, Owen, I'd suggest if Liverpool needs to go maybe and reinforce in terms of backup at centre half. But certainly if Lovren and Matip are happy to stay and play and be a part of the squad, yeah, absolutely no need to strengthen in that area for me.
It's interesting then when you look at the fullbacks, because if you've got consensus in the centre-backs, there's absolutely no question when it comes to the fullbacks that Andy Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold are your two there for the foreseeable future. You've got the likes of Nico Williams and Hoover as your backups to Trent Alexander-Arnold. They don't really have any backup to Andy Robertson on the left. Could this ever become an issue? I'm clutching at straws here, but could this ever become an issue where players have such a stranglehold on the jersey where even just an inkling of complacency might come in? Because nobody, as I say, comes close to taking the jersey off these two guys at the moment at Liverpool.
No, you're right. And that's where Klopp's got to come into the equation in terms of knowing your players. The good managers, they understand their players, the mentality of their players, what drives them. Can they trust them? If there's not that kind of competition for their place, is there going to be a drop-off? That complacency is going to set in. That's all about understanding your players as a manager, having your finger on the pulse. And if Klopp is assured that in Trent Alexander and Robertson, he doesn't have to worry about that. Oh, and they're so focused, so driven. Doesn't matter if they're being pushed or not. The level of performance is going to be the same. Then he doesn't really have to worry about that. He's got some good options. I've really liked the lad, Nico Williams. Every time I've seen him play, he's really impressed me. Certainly one for the future. I'd have no problems him coming in for an extended period in the team. The left-back's more an interesting one. Again, you could make an argument there on in terms of spending money, spending 10 million on literally just a backup left-back. Yeah, and you know, paying him a wedge. But I think actually within the squad, with the likes of James Milner and even Gomez, you remember Gomez came into the Liverpool team originally. He came in and actually played left-back. So you can make an argument for Gomez's versatility across the back four at centre-half, right-back and left-back is actually sufficient with the likes of James Milner and Nico Williams to actually cover any kind of potential problems which they might have across that defensive line without actually going out and spending.
There was a period when Spurs were essentially, they had four fullbacks and they kind of interchanged, and Pochettino did it so that everybody could play super high intensity week in, week out. Is there any point where they just go, Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold are so important to the width of the team and how we actually pin teams back and how we create space that we want them to be able to go full bore for 60% of the games, and actually we rest them for 40% of the games so that it's elongating their career and making sure that they are able to go high intensity. So it's not just about picking your best team all the time. You're literally giving them rest periods during the season.
Yeah, absolutely, Ger. And again, that comes back to the manager and the support staff, the physical conditioning people, knowing all your players. They'll have the computer data and all those players in terms of their physiology. They should know exactly what they're capable of. And every player is different in terms, even his physical, mental makeup. Jared, every player is different. Other players, you're absolutely right. You could make that argument. Look, we can only get 60% of the games out of this fella full pelt. We've got to be careful. We've got to rotate. We've got to take him out, put him back in. We've got to be really careful with Rackham and cotton wool. Other players, and not so much. I mean, the volume of games those two players, Robertson and Trent Alexander, have played has been absolutely phenomenal. But you're right, Jared, in terms of the medium to long term, you've got to be looking at this. They're going to be a detrimental effect maybe to that forward down the line. I think there's an argument for kind of taking a minute in and out of the team as of when. The amount of cup competitions that Liverpool play and maybe targeting certain Premier League games in terms of taking them out. But you're right when you say, Jared, in terms of their importance to the team, those two fullbacks is quite unique in terms of how Liverpool play, how advanced they get those fullbacks high up the pitch and how dependent they are in terms of their delivery into the box for goal scoring, to create goal scoring opportunities for other people. You really know other two fullbacks. You can argue, well, bring another two fullbacks and play 50-50 the games. But I can't think of another two fullbacks who would have the kind of impact on that Liverpool team in terms of goal scored and certainly goals chances created than those two fullbacks. So, yeah, I think it's a fair argument, but at the moment, I'd hang my hat on those two players. But I'd keep an eye on it. Even Robertson's performances of late, the Robertson performance at Manchester City was interesting just because we were just not used to seeing that kind of below-par performance from a Liverpool fullback. Some of Robertson's decision-making in those games, getting dragged into areas he shouldn't have gone, getting done in 1-2s and costing his team a couple of goals. Even small things like that, you wonder, maybe just a little bit of physical fatigue maybe creeping into Robertson's game there. So even that, I'm sure the Liverpool staff would be assessing that, thinking, you know what, maybe we just have to look after him. Maybe a little bit more than Alexander Arnold. He's a little bit different type of a beast. Maybe we've got to, next season, maybe we've got to protect him a little bit more, Robertson, the same games, the same moments during the season. But like I said, I think the answer's already within the squad. I suppose that's what I'm saying with the likes of Milner, Gomez's versatility, Nico Williams, etc. I really feel the answer's already there within the squad.
Let's move on to the midfield. So it's an interesting one that this has been the area where most of the talk has surrounded Liverpool in terms of going into the transfer market. Thiago Alcantara has been linked to the club. So you probably have your first choice three, Kenny, I presume, as Fabinho, Wijnaldum and Henderson. But at the same time, you do have a couple of potential bolters next season who have bolted in the past in Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain and Naby Keita. Like, I think there's probably still more to come from those two players, and there's a good chance that more will come. do they need to dip their foot into the water here? Do they need to go and get somebody like Alcantara to actually come to the club to ensure that the Sanders don't drop in midfield? Wijnaldum now has got 1 year left in his contract, by the way, so that could become an issue down the line.
No, well, I don't see the Thiago one at all, to be honest with you. Right. He's a fine player. He's a wonderful footballer. But the way Liverpool play and how they operate, I don't see how he fits in that Liverpool team whatsoever. You could argue he could operate the base of the midfield three, Thiago, in terms of being that kind of quarterback, but he can't defend. That lad can't, he can't go into the Liverpool team and that hold the midfield position, not being able to defend. He's not really number eight, Thiago, either, in terms of playing that advanced role hard up the pitch. So that's a no-go for me. I mean, the argument's redundant. They don't need it. They've got the option of Henderson and Fabinho in that holding midfield position. They can dovetail those two in that area of the pitch. Henderson has the versatility actually playing that higher position, that number eight role, hard up the pitch, alongside Wijnaldum, you're right. And then they've got the options of Keita and Oxlade-Chamberlain as well. Curtis Jones as well is going to be an option in that area of the pitch going forward as well. James Milner, a push, can come in there. So, again, as long as the attitude of the players is spot on, as long as Keita and Oxlade-Chamberlain are happy to get their heads down, work hard, and be and look to push for more game time. Again, I could see, in my own experience, you could see a situation maybe Keita could knock on the talk about Lovren knocking on the manager's door. Maybe Keita could knock on the manager's door in the summer and say, look, do you know what? This has been great, absolutely amazing, but I can't see myself getting the team here. It's so strong, the centre midfield area. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be playing 15, 20 games a season for the next two seasons. I'm in my prime here. I want to go and play again. So again, for me, that's the only situation where I'd envisage Klopp having to spend big in that area of the pitch. A lot of talk about Liverpool, how functional they are in that area of the pitch. Maybe not as creative. The kind of technical levels aren't on a par with Manchester City. And that's probably a fair point to be made in that respect. But it's all how the team actually functions, how they set up to play. So those type of players blend perfectly well in terms of how the Liverpool machine operates. So again, in terms of personnel, lads, I think it's absolutely perfect. I don't see the reason where you need to bring a player. There's plenty of options there for me. Curtis Jones as well could be one who really comes on strong at the start of the next season. So there's another option for the manager in that area of the pitch. So again, I just don't feel as if he needs to tweak too much in that area of the pitch. For me, again, is the answer. As long as the attitude of the players is spot on and Klopp gets a sense of the players, the focus is still there, that determination, that kind of ambition to go and win back-to-back titles and win more trophies and be the best and create a dynasty. As long as he gets a sense of that around the place, for me, there's almost no argument for in terms of really strengthening that squad considerably.
Could you explain to us why exactly Thiago is a different sort of midfielder and why it would be a square peg in a round hole?
Well, for me, maybe this is more of a personal thing. Well, Liverpool play with like that kind of V-shaped midfield. They play the whole midfield of number six and two number eight, pretty much the same as a Manchester City. Now, we've kind of had the argument about Henderson and Fabinho last season, and it is an interesting argument. I think it's not so much for me one player is better than the other. One player has different attributes to the other player. For me, Jordan Henderson is a better holding midfield, has better defensive attributes than Fabinho. Fabinho's probably had a better all-rounded game, a better passer of the ball than Jordan Henderson. But I think they can both play in that area of the pitch. For me, Fabinho has enough defensive qualities to operate in that area of the pitch. Not as strong as I personally would like, and not as strong as Henderson's, but still very effective in that area of the pitch. Henderson can do that role as well. When I look at Thiago, and I've seen a lot of Thiago play, he's a brilliant technical player. Reminds me a little bit maybe Jorginho, and I'd have the same argument with Jorginho at Chelsea. For me, there's no future for Jorginho at Chelsea. If Chelsea want to win a league title, they can't win a league title where Jorginho playing that holding midfield for Chelsea. And Thiago's a similar player, brilliant in terms of receiving the ball from the defensive line, getting on the half turn and working the ball up the pitch, breaking the lines with his pass, and technically lovely array of pass, and ticks all those boxes in possession of the football when he's got the ball at his feet. On but out of possession, I mean, he's not an athlete, he's not the most dynamic, has got that defensive mindset in terms of sensing danger, cutting off channels, physically imposing himself, winning tackles, dropping into space, covering people, all of those things. And I think whatever league you play in, those type of attributes are important. For me, even more so in the Premier League, I think that type of holding midfielder with that kind of defensive mindset is absolutely paramount if you're going to be successful and go and win titles. Man City have had it with Fernandinho when they've won their league titles. You even look at the Leicester team, the likes of Kante and Drinkwater. you know, those type of players, Henderson as well. Fabinho has enough of that for me, just in terms of positional senses, and has enough to get by in terms of what's around them as well, in terms of the work ethic around them. So that's why Thiago, for me, as wonderful a footballer as he is, I don't see that fit at all, personally, him coming to Liverpool. If there was a centre midfield player, if you were to ask me, if there's a player out there who could really elevate Liverpool, Liverpool wouldn't have to necessarily change how they play to accommodate him. It would be Kai Havertz, Leverkusen. For me, he's the one. I think if Klopp's going to spend big, potentially, over the next year or so, he's the type of player for me. I would sacrifice Naby Keita midfield. I would sell Naby Keita now for 30, 40 million and go and spend 80 million to get this fella in. Because this fella, for me, is almost a complete player. He has that physical presence, 6'2", 6'3", good athlete, good, decent work ethic, but a high level of technical ability. Brilliant left-footed player, beautiful to watch, and a good box-to-box player. Engine, gets into the box, good header of the ball, arrives late, can actually win a header and score goals. So that type of player, for me, I think that's down the road. I don't think that'll happen now, but potentially, if you were saying the next year or two, when's that next big money signing for Liverpool, that kind of elite player, where is he going to come in? For me, if I had to offer me a player now, it would be him. It would be Havertz, or Bayern Leverkusen, in terms of really elevating that Liverpool squad. But again, for me, he's not a necessity at this moment in time. Probably won't be able to get him out of Leverkusen anyway.
Is it correct, Kenny, that the current piece in the jigsaw that they already have that would be more similar to him is Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain? Like, is it kind of an ability to play on the wing, but obviously Liverpool don't necessarily need that quality all the time, considering how set their right winger position is, that it's almost an attacking midfielder who has midfielder sensibilities?
Yeah, it's a good point about Oxlade-Chamberlain, that kind of versatility. You've seen that in the modern game now, Owen, in terms of players who can operate in different positions, not only across the front line, but also one of those central midfield areas. Not too many of them around, people who can play in a midfield three, Owen, and also operate across to the front line as well. Oxlade-Chamberlain is one of those, can play in that advanced midfield area, can operate off the flanks as well. Havertz has got that kind of versatility as well, believe it or not. Yeah, so you're right. I think that's one of Liverpool's strengths as well, that kind of versatility in terms of Oxlade-Chamberlain can go into the front line as well. And if you want to take it on to Liverpool front line, you've got the likes of Origi, Minamino. Minamino is a different type of player. Looks more like a number 10 for me. Not really ideally suited to one of those central midfield positions, are actually one of the wide positions the way Liverpool play. Always wants to come on the inside really and play in the pocket. So he's a different type of beast to what they've already had, but still a good option to have off the bench. So for me, Liverpool's still got those good options in Origi, Minamino, Oxlade-Chamberlain. If you want to take out one of those front three, or you lose them for a period of time, and you still have decent options there in terms of players to bring into the squad. The young lad Harvey Ellis just signed a new contract as well. He could be one who could really bloom over the next 6 to 12 months. So if Klopp has confidence in those younger players coming through, no need for him to go and put his money in his wallet and go and spend the kind of money he needs to strengthen around the periphery of the squad. Again, for me, the answer could already be there in terms of the qualities of those younger players who are pushing to come through.
It's looking like, if you're looking at Kai Havertz price tags, it's looking between 80 to 105, 110 million pounds. Like, I mean, Chelsea have been linked with them as well. Whether or not they'll do a Werner Havertz double this window probably looks doubtful. So they might get away with waiting until next year. Hopefully a few more pounds are back in the coffers and they might be able to make a move for him then. He's contracted to Leverkusen until 2022. So you heard it here first, Havertz to Liverpool, although he has actually been linked with the club previously. Front three, Kenny, I presume this is going to be the quickest one of all. The front three picks themselves. The drop-off to Minamino then, if you want to use him as the next best option across the front three, is that too significant a drop-off in your view?
No, I don't think so. I think I wouldn't talk down Origi too much. Origi's probably the one for me best suited to operate in any of those front three positions. He can play down the middle or off the flank. Seems to have a good attitude, the lad, in terms of, you know, spends a lot of time on the bench, but again shows the right attitude when he comes on the pitch. And that's important, because if you're a forward player at Liverpool, your name's not Mo Salah, Firmino or Mane, you're just not going to play. You're literally not going to play. And it's not an argument. You can't even see those players being rotated. When those three players are fit, they play. It's as simple as that. And that's one of the reasons probably why they're not. They haven't been looking for a move. You never hear stories coming out that Liverpool Football Club, one of those front three aren't happy, keep getting substituted, not getting enough game time. if Liverpool are going to keep those players over the next 2 to 3 years and keep them out of the hands of the likes of whatever, Barcelona, Real Madrid, that's not to say like necessarily those clubs are in a better place than Liverpool, but you know, it's like saying players, the draw of kind of Barcelona and Real Madrid is always a big one for some players, not necessarily about money, etc. So to keep those players focused and happy, they've got to play, those three have got to play every single time that they're fit. So every player knows that coming in. I'm amazed Timo Werner even would have considered getting on the flight and going to Liverpool to talk to Jurgen Klopp. Because the first question he asked Jurgen Klopp and his agent surely would have been, where do you see me playing in this team? And Jurgen Klopp would have said, well, I don't. You don't play. You don't play in this team with that front three. Now, what player of any quality, any standard in the game is going to sign for Liverpool, the greatest football team as they are, knowing that you're not going to play? You're just going to have to wait for a fair share of the games. It's as simple as that. Every player
is Is there no room for somebody to take Firmino's place? Like, Firmino is obviously an excellent player, but seems a little bit low on confidence at the moment.
Oh, no. I wouldn't look over a game or two, and certainly not at the moment, Jared, in terms of where Liverpool are, league being won and focus being a little bit. For me, I'd make an argument that Firmino's become even more key to that Liverpool team over the past 12 months. The type of player he is, how he operates, Jared, how he drops off, links things up, opens those spaces for the other two to run in behind. He's the perfect foil for kind of Mane and Salah, how they want to play. They want to run in behind all the time, run into those spaces. That's where they want to operate. And for Firmino's game complements that. He understands that. So he's prepared to drop off, drag centre-halves under the ball, open those spaces up. And it's not just that, he's prepared to drop off. Technically, he's excellent as well, playing on the half-turn, his link-up play. And he's actually, for me, Jerry, actually finishing is, I've been most impressed with his finishing, to the extent where, before the lockdown, I was looking at him, remember the World Club final before Christmas, and I was thinking to myself, do you know what, if a chance fell to a Liverpool forward at the moment in terms of, and they needed a goal, whether it was for the Champions League or whatever, Firmino's probably the one. Firmino is the player who shows real composure in front of the goal inside the penalty box and has been this season. That scenario game has actually improved. He wasn't seen as a prolific goal scorer when he first came to the football club. But he's the one, just as much as the other two lads, if a chance fell in front of the box, he's the one showing the composure, having the extra touch, lifting the ball over the goalkeeper. His finishing is as good as the other two. So I'd actually argue the opposite. I'd argue Firmino has actually become more important in terms of how Liverpool, that front three, functions over the past year or so. Yeah. So they're pretty much untouchable. The only reason, again, you'll see Liverpool spend 100 million on the top class forward-thinking player, whether it's Sancho or somebody else, it'll have to be one out and one in. One of those players will have to go to accommodate one of these higher profile, top heavy signings to come into the football club. It's as simple as that. In the meantime, you just supplement those players as best you can. And again, for me, the answer is within the squad in the shape of Origi, Minamino, Oxlade-Chamberlain, and even young Harvey. And I'm pleased for him because it means more opportunity for those young players to kind of develop and bloom within the football club.
And Rian Brewster coming back on loan from loan as well is another one. And just a final point then before we wrap. This morning, actually, Christian Falk, the journalist with Bild, who's on top of a lot of transfer news, has actually tweeted that Kai Havertz will ask his club, Bayer Leverkusen, to sell him this summer. And he's included at Chelsea in the tweet. You do wonder if perhaps Liverpool's hand might be forced because Chelsea have already gazumped them on one big transfer this summer. Could Liverpool make a special dispensation to splash the cash on Kai Havertz? So that'll be one to watch over the next couple of weeks. Kenny, great stuff. So one change for Liverpool. The depth chart only needs one addition, really. We'll do it again same time next year where perhaps more additions need to be done. Kenny, cheers.
Cheers, lads.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Graham Hunter is here. How are you, Graham?
I'm grand, thanks. Are you?
I'm okay. Let's talk first off about Lionel Messi. It's kind of a conversation we've been having for quite some time this year, but it sort of feels that the news is getting more and more real. So just this question for you. of all the times you've seen these Lionel Messi... Of all these Lionel Messi stories you've seen over the last few years, where does this particular one rank in terms of legitimacy? It definitely feels up there in terms of the most legitimate links.
Ah, that's a beautiful intro, right? We'll try and make this real, okay? And not like all the previous conversations on. Look, it's much simpler than that. Than the you want me to go on the Messiometer. We don't need all sort of gadgets and swings. And he started free the other week, His contract allowed him to walk away free at the end of this season, even though he's got one more year of contract. It was written in this get-out clause. As long as he notified them by the end of May, he didn't do that. Immediately, that didn't happen. The club naturally, because as poor a president as Bartomeu has been, he doesn't want to leave in 1 year's time because his mandate is also up. It's interesting how his contract runs out in a year's time. Now, he is mandated that he must resign in a year. They must call elections. That's obligatory. He doesn't want to be the president who is branded as the one that let Messi go. So if Messi doesn't renew, then by next summer, not only will there be a free-for-all, it'll be a blemish on Bartomeu's record for all time. So immediately, May finished and the pandemic allowed Barcelona to come back and train and play and plan and work together again. They started to try to talk to him about a new contract. And Messi's people said, no, we're not interested. Stop. Go away. Forget it. They didn't say, we're leaving. They said, we're not interested in talking right now. And immediately that leaked out. To be fair, when it leaked out on the Crossbar show on radio, pardon me, where they, you know, despite often being on between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m., they still got a million listeners. It was reported as, at the moment, Messi doesn't want to think about staying. At the moment, Messi... And the clarity that needs to be brought into that is that he should be looking around at 33 on at his options. He should, rather than be thinking about whether he can up his gross annual income from 100 million to 120 million, he's got two, maybe, I mean, I keep saying two when I talk about this, but at 33, he can still look utterly brilliant. He will become, at the end of this campaign, he'll be Barcelona's most important player. He'll probably be La Liga's best player. The weekend's exploits mean that he now has his fingerprints on, I think, 52 goals between those he scored and assists this season alone, a season in which he's lost a lot of time to injury. He's turned 33. He's in a deeply declining team, and he's deeply dissatisfied with what he sees around him. This will go down as a statistical mark to equal some of his other marks of pure genius that we've seen. So that's the situation. There's no need for speculation or is he definitely leaving? We're in a moment where currently ranked the world's best player, given that he's a Ballon d'Or holder and still extraordinary at 33. He's looking around and I say, why wouldn't you know that? You don't need to be reporting on La Liga rather than based in Dublin to see the logic of him going, I'm going to check my options because I'm not going to throw away two more good years when I could be winning trophies, when I could be doing special things, if this squad isn't going to be better, if this club's not going to be better run.
There was a report in Argentina over the course of the weekend that Manchester United could make an offer of up to £120 million plus two players. You had Pep Guardiola asked about it and he says he hopes he stays in Barcelona. You had a situation now where, as you say, he's going to go into his last year of his contract, which doesn't suit Barcelona either. So all these things are kind of coming to a head at the moment. Like, is there a club in world football at the moment who could A, interest Lionel Messi and B, afford to bring him to the club? Like, I mean, interestingly, Lionel Messi probably comes with Champions League football. Manchester City might not have that to offer him outside of them. Can you realistically see him going to a Paris Saint-Germain? Maybe not. And that does leave Manchester United and that link from the report in Argentina over the course of the weekend as one of the viable options, which kind of seems incredible given where they were a few months ago.
It sounds utter tosh to me. Mm. I mean, I haven't read it and therefore I should be journalistically more respectful to another organisation. But, you know, Owen, if you put the magnifying glass on it, as you yourself were doing, what was the deal? You said 100 and what?
£120 million plus two players.
£120 million plus two players for a guy that's 33 and out of contract at the end of the season. Why wouldn't you wait a season and take him for free? Why wouldn't you start the contacts now Why would you pay all that money? I don't understand it. You know, I think there's a good argument that Leo Messi sitting right now, sitting in Barcelona, I don't want to renew because I'm not sure. I need time. Instead of trying to buy him, go to him and say, okay, in 12 months, we will take you. We will make your life heaven. We will be in a position to win the Champions League then. We'll be able to show you a vastly improved squad and you don't spend 100 and something million and nick out two players. I don't know. I can't see how that report, it doesn't make sense to me at all. Manchester United is a venue for him. Maybe the club that has tried hardest to get him over now his entire career is Manchester City. It wasn't the case. Inter tried, Real Madrid tried when he was a youngster. Inter tried really, really hard. But Manchester City's owners, long before Pep was in charge, two, three coaches before Pep was in charge, were desperate to get Messi, put unbelievable financial incentives there for him, and still covet him. And I understand as why owners would covet him. The ruling about Manchester City's participation in the Champions League patently is very important. And I'm not convinced at all that taking what Pep Guardiola said about Messi, I hope he stays and completes his career at Barcelona. Take that aside. I'm not entirely sure what Pep Guardiola's view would be if you said, as owners, Pep, we're going to give you Messi. Outright rejection of it, no, but his plan of football is much more dynamic. Messi is a different kind of footballer. Genius though he is, he's a different kind of footballer than Pep inherited in 2008-09, different kind of footballer than when Pep left. It would mean a reorientation of how Manchester City play up front when they press, who does and doesn't track back. It would be a really big jump. And to be honest with you, if you said to me that during this season Messi doesn't renew his contract and Pep sees out his 1 year and it's a 1 year ban in the Champions League and Pep decides to move on because in due course he'll want to coach Brazil, in my opinion, and there's a new coach at Manchester City, Messi's out of contract and just turning 34 and Manchester City are back in the Champions League, if you said to me, is that a possible change? Possible? And Barcelona are still in a chaotic state? I'd say possible. But my opinion is that Messi will want to wait and see how the likely presidential winner, Victor Font, is shaping up during this year. He's going to wait and see what, if anything, Barcelona do in coaching terms this year, does City and stay or not. And Messi has got a bigger word now in how the team shape is. The weekend proved that. Messi asked City for specific tactical changes. They were granted. Griezmann moved in the centre, played next to Suarez, Messi in behind. Jordi Alba got freedom down the left. They played as if it was 2015. It's one of the most remarkable switchbacks from playing horribly to playing convincingly that I've seen. And therefore, we're in a state of flux. On if you want to talk about other clubs and where Messi might or might not go, that's fine as a hypothesis. But what's happening here is that Messi is surveying what he's got, surveying what else there is, and taking time to make a decision. And I think that's wise. I'd say it'd be crazy to say, oh, I'm just staying. My kids are happy, the family's happy, the lifestyle here is good. I owe Barcelona. I'm definitely staying for the last two brilliant years of my career. That would be naive, and he's not naive.
It's very interesting that he's had such a hand in the tactical shift, isn't it? Because I was going to ask you about the possibility that the new president of Barcelona, the power brokers, grant Messi his wish with a manager, whoever he wants to come in and manage the club. Xavi is who I'm thinking. Bring him back to Barcelona, give him to Messi as his manager. But the way you're talking now, it seems that perhaps Messi may have influence even with Setien.
You put me on dangerous ground there. If I'm completely honest, Xavi is such a shrewd beast that I think there's, how can I put this carefully, a lot of received wisdom that Xavi's ideal stage of taking over is something akin to what Guardiola got in 2008, where some of the big beasts are no longer in your way. Now, Guardiola had to push out Ronaldinho and Deco. Situation with Messi is not the same. But my impression is that Xavi would really like a time machine so that he could start with 25-year-old Messi. But if he isn't granted that, then perhaps, how can I say it carefully and euphemistically, clear ground to make his own decisions about the style of play. Does that Does that get the message across?
Just about, Graham.
And therefore, Messi is a new era, yeah, with space to make decisions that are fully his own. And look, you know, Messi, let's not create a myth. I didn't mean to start the myth that Messi snaps his fingers and everything happens his way at the club. That's not true. But Setien was wise, given the mess of the playing style, given how disconsolate several players, Griezmann included, disconsolate, given the fact that Alba, Suarez and Messi were very nearly at daggers drawn with Setien and his volatile, mouthy assistant, Eder Sarabia. When Messi said, listen, coach, I think this will work. I want this to happen. That's happened time immemorial in football clubs and international selections where a senior player can say to a coach, this will work. And the coach goes, okay, I'm going to back you. So don't let that message sound like Messi's a martinet. That's not, he's a tough little tyke. And when you're in his bad books, coach, president, fellow player, doesn't matter. When you're in his bad books, you know. But what happened was constructive, creative, and it was right of Setien to go, okay, I listen, I see the tactical improvements, I see what you want, I see what Suarez wants, I see it. And they did it and it worked out their treat. It doesn't mean that Messi runs the club, and it also doesn't mean that Messi's going to the new president. I appoint Xavi. I don't see that.
Right, it's a very, very interesting situation. Like the timing of when those two things happen is going to be very, very curious, and I didn't realise a lot of that. Like, what we were going to get into, to Graham, actually, was a little bit of Real Madrid, but I think what's actually probably more interesting with Real Madrid at the moment is possibly their post-Ronaldo life. If you look at, perhaps, the last few weeks in isolation, they've won all their games in the resumption. What is it, 2-0, 1-0, 1-0, 1-0 have been their last four wins. They've been robust in defence, only conceded one goal since the return. Does the post-Ronaldo life at Real Madrid look anything akin to how the post-Messi life at Barcelona will look? Or are the structures just so utterly different that you are not comparing like with like?
I think it's important to make that comparison, because Real Madrid have ripped up what was the Galactico idea. They've got an engorged squad. They've got far too many players. I mean, once he takes, you know, good first-team players back from loan, there's 30-something top-quality footballs in that squad. And elite managers now like to have a maximum sort of 21, 22 with some kids around the fringes. Well, that's not the case at Real Madrid. And what's happened is that Florentino Perez's idea that with nation states owning clubs, there's a fighting chance that Real Madrid won't be always able to buy Galacticos, because the Galacticos may now increasingly go, as Mbappe did at a very young age before he was proven, went to PSG. PSG managed to take Neymar. City spend slightly differently, but fair play aside, have a similar capacity. The idea of Newcastle being bought by the Saudis and automatically buying Neymar doesn't add up, but Florentino Perez anticipated that there might be more and more of these, and so he switched idea. And having lost Neymar, he hired a team of scouts to go to Brazil and said, bring me the next three Neymars. You know, when the Empire Strikes Back, I don't want one, I want three. So he's got Renier, he's got Rodrigo, he's got Vinicius, all interesting, exciting young talents. He's got Taki Kubo out at Mallorca. Asensio's still only 24. If you look at Odegaard at La Real, he was playing brilliantly for the first half of the season. So what's coming now, they've just sold Ashraf to Inter when he could have walked back into that team because they think that Mondi is good enough. There is an influx of highly talented youth at Real Madrid. It's looking like they need to refine in very specific ways. There's not an awful lot of work needed to be done at Real Madrid, but because of the pandemic, the market shrinking, the amount of time you've got to do business, the amount of money that's around, how Real Madrid clear out four or five, starting with Bale, obviously, they want to move him out. Starting with, I mean, the James Rodriguez wants to go to Atleti across the city. Controversial move. The business they've got to do, this post-Ronaldo construction that you talked about, has been difficult for the first year, but now they're going to win what is only, I think, their ninth title since 1990. I think they will win it. Their four-point gap is sufficient. I don't see them tripping up. it's still arithmetically all to play for, but Real Madrid's triumph this year will be very important in that post-Ronaldo context that you mentioned. What they've got is a structure. Valverde is still, I think, only 22. He's exceptional. Casemiro is still only 28. It needs retouching, nothing more. Really specifics, though. They need another striker. Jovic doesn't work. They need to have the pressure taken off Benzema. But that Real Madrid squad is exceptional. Asensio's come back from a year-long injury looking dandy, absolutely dandy. So if you're a Madridista or even a neutral who doesn't want to see Barcelona dominating all the time, Madrid paints you a really interesting next 2-3 years. And as the neutrals, never mind the team on the club crest, there are 2 or 3 footballers in there. Vinicius, Taki, Rainier carries a massive reputation, but he's still to be old enough to be pushing his way into that first team. Asensio. There are footballers to watch there that we'll be enjoying for 5, 6, 7 years to come. That the next 24 months paint as really interesting for Real Madrid.
And for Zidane as well, and for him to get the credit as a coach that perhaps hasn't quite been there on a global scale. Nobody talks about Zinedine Zidane as one of the great coaches in world football, and yet look at the success that he's had.
I think, Gerard, if it's all right to use the P word at breakfast time in Ireland, let me be pedantic. I'm not sure he's proven yet to be, sorry about that, everybody, just put the cornflakes down, just step away from the anger. I'm not certain he's necessarily, don't laugh, he's necessarily the world's greatest coach. I think he's still, I think he said it himself the other day, I was always a better player than I am a coach. I think what he is something that's still extremely special, that has become more important. And you can make a comparison with Ferguson, for example. Zidane is very, very good in terms of understanding his group, man management, but also I've used on your show the player whisperer idea that he's extremely good at reorientating somebody's concentration. I want this job from you. He's extremely good at taking the senior, wizened old pros and saying, we're not done here and we're not playing the way you want to. This is what I need from you. He's very good at creating a meritocracy. He's really good at promoting the idea that if training is good every day, we win titles. But if training is good every day, I'll give a premium to those who train well. You won't be, there won't be the president bought me there, therefore I'm completely safe and I can do what I want. And that feeling has existed over the years at Real Madrid. And it's part of the reason that since 1990, they've only won whatever it is, eight titles. So Zidane's ability to get the best out of multimillionaires, some of whom can coast, some of whom can be disaffected because they're not playing 38 times a season in the league. These elements distinguish him, I think, from the rest. And his coaching, you can see that he makes in-game changes that are adequate. He's changed system a lot over his, I guess he's coached as the first team man in charge about 205, 206 times now. And in about 185 of those, it's been a different 11. So he loves to rotate. He loves to challenge. I think he can tweak that and occasionally go for spells of games where it's the same 11 or the same 10 much more regularly and become European competitive again. But he had them playing, and I think the cup idea, that's where you see him inspiring individual players, clusters of players. And I think it helps account for the domination of the Champions League they had, but they've lost. And I think that's how you distinguish Zidane, somebody who's very special and still running, still involved in training. So his coach, David Bitoni, is on the side watching and instructing how the training sessions should be. But Zidane will be very much involved in the 1-2s, the set-up, the short games, not to show off what he can do, but to say, I want the tempo like this. I want your touch to be like this. The shooting from distance is a big factor that he's introduced. Up until the last two games where opponents have closed them down, they were shooting at goal 15, 16 times on average every game and scoring from distance, I think, more than anybody in Europe. So he's an interesting man. He's going to be a successful man this season. It's wonderful to have him because he's elegant and funny for us who like to watch and chronicle what's going on. But I'd count him more as a player whisperer, as a man manager, than an elite coach.
One last point, Graham. This is a conversation that Ger and I found ourselves in earlier on, let's just put it that way, where we were talking about this current Liverpool side and we were talking about their three midfielders and how, if you compare football from between now and 10 years ago, I mean, the responsibility on the midfield is very different, because you look in the context of the Spanish team 10 years ago, one of the best midfields we've ever seen, whereas Liverpool play in a way that is on vogue, but is it playing in a way that perhaps doesn't bestow as much responsibility on passing midfielders. First of all, would you go along with that? And second of all, then, if you had to transport that Spain team into current club football, how would they fare against the Manchester Cities, the Liverpools, the high-octane counter-pressing and things like that? Is it a totally ridiculous take to suggest that perhaps Spain were an outstanding team, but also perfect for their time?
First of all, okay, I'll take your second part of your question. It's a hypothesis, so we can have fun. Mm. But I spent the last several weeks creating podcasts about 2010. I was there, I accompanied them all the way, but I watched all the training sessions. I think that Spain team, the first thing to say is that it's rare, it's not unheard of, but it's rare that you have your first 16 players in a squad like that are as good as that. I think that's rare. I think that another thing I've learned in subsequent tournaments with Spain is how rare it is to have personalities like that. Intensely hard, tungsten tough winners. Thirdly, that Spain team would win everything. Never mind the change of style of play. What Spain had to cope with then was backs of 9 and 10 in front of them. Barely anybody wanted to play. When Germany wanted to play, the score was only 1-0 because Germany were extremely good. But when they wanted to play, Spain's football was absolutely terrific. In my humble opinion, you had a 2010 side where David Silva was barely used. He was conducting his transfer at Manchester City. Del Bosque lost a bit of faith in him. David Silva had so much more to give to that team. If you look at his stats in the World Cup, when Mata's stats in the World Cup, Javi Martinez's stats in the World Cup, basically didn't get any. Marcus Senna was, you know, a fantastic player for Villarreal and got left behind at that stage. All I'm saying is that irrespective of the pace of football now, that Spain team yearned for clubs that come at you, that open up, that if not toe-to-toe, that don't sit in bank defences. They beat them. They beat, you know, Paraguay bank defence, Chile bank defence, and Portugal were relatively defensive against them. And you no matter about how football changes, if you mix brilliance and utterly hard mentality, you win enough. As far as Liverpool are concerned, you used the word responsibility, and then you qualified it by talking about passing responsibility. And okay, a lot of the passing is done by the full backs of Van Dijk. And teams are learning a little bit about how to play Liverpool. It's just like learning how to play them and being able to affect it and beat them or dull them is difficult. Liverpool's biggest enemy is themselves, because the responsibility for that midfield is an athleticism that we've rarely seen, a winning of the ball and a speed of transition. And those three things jigsawed together mean that you individually and the guy to your right and your left and the guy who's on the bench need to be mentally and physically in an extraordinary shape. And patterns of great clubs have shown you need to renew that, because you can't keep a group of men playing at that level where it's all about intensity and mental focus, not genius, you know, at the same level, winning level again and again and again for clutches of 4 or 5 seasons. It has to be the case that somebody better, somebody younger, somebody hungrier, somebody who's not used to winning, somebody who'll challenge you for your place must come in. So you were talking about playing philosophies. Liverpool's massive challenge now, because they've been brilliant. They are, in my lifetime, one of the 2-3 great selection selling outfits in terms of how to work academy and transfer market. They've been extraordinary. How do you retouch? Retouching is completely different from reconstructing. Mm. They've done the reconstructing. The finesse of saying that little change and that little change and this one in and that one out, or this one less bench time, that will be fascinating to watch. And the rivals will all be sitting going, we can trip them up now. They will, you know, they will.
Yeah. Graham Hunter, fascinating stuff as always. Thanks a million for joining us.
Cheers.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.